Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.14, Islamic Modernism. So, I want to start out today by giving a quick shout-out to listener and new friend of mine, Ben Little, who encouraged me to do this episode. Ben is a fellow amateur historian whose great passion is filling out the Wikipedia articles on the late Ottoman Empire, which honestly is God's work. We all thank you for that. Anyways, shout out to Ben Little, and I'm looking forward to our next Zoom call. So, last time, we followed the young Turks as they scattered across Europe and North Africa, setting up shop in Paris, Geneva, and Cairo, where they could safely criticize Abdulhamid under the protection of the European powers. And as we saw, the positivist scholar and chief editor of Meshfret, Ahmed Reza, quickly rose to prominence within the CUP. However, his leadership was then briefly interrupted by the arrival of Minzani Murad Bey, a prominent journalist who became popular primarily because he was more open to coups, revolutions, and great power intervention than was Ahmed Reza. So, Minzani Murad used this more activist platform to take over the CUP in November of 1896, and he would move party headquarters from Paris to Geneva. But just as quickly as he had come, Minzani Murad would abandon his post as leader of the CUP after less than a year, when Sultan Abdulhamid's childhood best friend and top intelligence agent, Ahmed Celaleddin, successfully convinced many young Turks to take their old jobs back, and many decided to return to their cushy lifestyle working for the Sultan's government. And for outside observers, this mass defection of young Turks back into the Sultan's camp seemed like it would spell an end to the entire movement. But the extreme stubbornness of Ahmed Reza, which had recently been a liability as he fell out of favor in the CUP, specifically because he had clung so tightly to his anti-revolutionary positivist credo, was now his greatest asset. Because Reza stubbornly held fast to his principles and refused all offers made by Celaleddin to try and convince him to come work for Sultan Abdulhamid. And after Minzani Murad and the Geneva Circle defected en masse, Ahmed Reza would make great hay out of this betrayal, painting those in Geneva as weak-kneed posers who had no real desire to see the empire actually changed, and who were unwilling to do the hard, necessary work in standing up to the Red Sultan. So, Ahmed Reza would present himself as the true defender of the Young Turk cause. And amongst those young Turks who also refused the offers of the Sultan, or who were not quite lucky enough to receive such offers, they would no longer see Ahmed Reza as an annoying positivist too obsessed with gradual reform, but instead they would come to see him as a fierce and principled opponent to Abdulhamid. This shift in the perception of Ahmed Reza would not only stem from his refusal of the Sultan's offers to buy him out, but would also come from an actual shift in the tone of Reza's public pronouncements. Because following the mass defection of those surrounding Minzani Murad, Ahmed Reza began to declare himself as a bit more open to revolutionary action, saying things like, quote, "It was said that the leader hinders action, revolution, and all kinds of success. I never repudiated the necessity for a legitimate revolution and its advantages. I mentioned why I was against action. Nevertheless, I held back nobody's hand." This conception of a legitimate revolution was a departure from Ahmed Reza's previous position, in which he held strong to the belief that society needed to be changed through orderly, rational, and gradual reform. And this reveals how Ahmed Reza was not just some brainy positivist scholar stubbornly attached to the anti-revolutionary ideology of Auguste Comte for purely intellectual reasons. Ahmed Reza was now revealing himself to be a practical political leader, willing to tactically adapt his approach in the face of broad unpopularity. And ultimately, Ahmed Reza's increasing openness to legitimate revolutionary action will forge a key alliance leading up to 1908. the alliance between Ahmed Reza and his Paris circle with the so-called activist wing of the CUP, who would remain in Geneva after the departure of Minzani Murad. Now, it will take some time for this alliance to fully mature, but Ahmed Reza and the activist Young Turks, who wanted to go beyond mere words in their battle against the Sultan, would begin to come together after the defection of Minzani Murad and his circle. Because as the weak-kneed posers went back to their old cushy jobs working for the Sultan, Ahmed Reza and the activists now respected one another as fellow defenders of the true faith. So, these activist Young Turks, who elected to remain in Europe following the defection of Minzani Murad, would begin to gather around the original CUP founder, Ishak Shukuti, who would step into the void and attempt to reorganize the Geneva branch of the CUP. And as Ishak Shukuti tried to reestablish Geneva as the center of CUP operations, Shukuti would of course bicker with Ahmed Reza, who was always wanting to move headquarters back to Paris. But eventually, Shukuti and Reza would see the value in joining forces. And at the beginning of 1898, the Geneva branch, now under Ishak Shukuti's leadership, began publishing a new journal entitled Osmanli. And Osmanli, which just means Ottoman, would become the new mouthpiece for the CUP. And though Ahmed Reza would continue to publish Meshvaret, he would now only publish it in French, and the real center of action for the CUP would become the Osmanli Journal coming out of Geneva. The first manifesto published by Osmanli reveals a pretty dramatic change in the tone of Young Turk publications. And just to give you a little flavor of it, I'm going to read you part of this manifesto. Quote, "Muslims, Abdulhamid is neither the Sultan nor the Caliph, according to our religion. Those who doubt our words should look into the Holy Quran and Sunnah. Our committee revealed the orders of God and the Prophet to the government and the people by publishing sacred verses and hadiths. Abdulhamid turned away from them and proved that he is a tyrant and does not hesitate to disobey God. Therefore, our people should have resorted to arms. Sadly, they have not done so and thus have proven that they were also unrighteous. Our committee declared war on Abdulhamid, who has not kept his word as is enjoined by the Holy Quran. Be reasonable, Muslims, be reasonable. Abdulhamid is annihilating the religion and the state. Please rise and slash this fake caliph and his accomplices to pieces. Give up your lives and kill." So yeah, we're no longer like debating French sociological theories over here. Things are getting pretty real. And of course, one of the most striking aspects of this manifesto is its call for a religious war to be waged against Abdulhamid. But one development that is quite interesting to note is that at the very same time that this new activist wing in Geneva was beginning to deploy the language of a religious struggle, these activists were also working to establish an alliance with the Armenian revolutionary parties. The Dashnaks had been calling for an alliance with the Young Turks in their newspaper, Droshak, for over a year at this point, meaning that the Armenians were actually the initiators of this rapprochement with the Young Turks. But with the reorganization of the Geneva branch under the leadership of Ishak Shukuti and the activist wing, the CUP would begin to form an alliance with the Dashnaks. Now, this alliance was kept a close secret because the CUP knew that it would be unpopular amongst the pious Muslims who they were now clearly trying to win over. But both the Young Turks and the Armenian revolutionaries had come to see value in uniting their efforts to oppose Abdulhamid. For the Dashnaks, the primary criticism that they had been hurling at Young Turk leaders like Ahmed Reza had always been that they were just a bunch of brainy intellectuals who only wanted to write in their oppositional journals from the safety of Europe, accusing them of being unwilling to take any sort of real action against the Sultan. And seeing as a huge chunk of the Young Turks had just taken their old jobs back, literally working for the Ottoman administration, yeah, you can kind of see why the Dashnaks might accuse the Young Turks of being like fake revolutionaries. because while Young Turks like Ahmed Rza and Benzani Mourad were publishing academic journals from their ivory towers in Geneva and Paris, Armenian Dashnaks had been carrying out an all-out war against Abdulhamid's regime in eastern Anatolia through an ongoing campaign of assassinations, guerrilla raids, and calculated acts of political terrorism. So, for the Dashnaks, it was seen as a very positive development that the Young Turks were finally becoming more aggressive in their rhetoric. The Armenian revolutionaries could not topple Abdulhamid on their own. So, even though the Dashnaks were not crazy about the Young Turks deploying Islamic rhetoric to rile up the masses, they were willing to look past this if it meant that the Young Turks might begin to move past mere words in their fight against the Red Sultan. So, following the defection of Benzani Mourad, the Young Turks running Osmanli from Geneva would take on a more activist approach, as they both sought to forge new alliances with the more radical elements of the opposition, such as the Armenian revolutionaries, and they also began to use the language of a religious struggle in order to appeal to pious Muslims and to encourage them to rise up against Abdulhamid. In general, moving into the 20th century, the CUP will become increasingly more open to deploying Islam as a propaganda device in the hopes of galvanizing the people to take action against Abdulhamid, whom they would now begin to paint as a usurper of Islam and as a fake caliph. And while we should understand this in part as a cynical use of religious propaganda made by secularized intellectuals who didn't really actually care that much about religion, this is not quite the full story. And even though the Manifesto of Osmanli did represent a shift in the tone of Young Turk publications, this was definitely not the first time that Young Turks had tried to win over pious Muslims. As early as 1894, even before the mass exodus of Young Turks to Europe, CUP founder Ishak Shakuti, who would be the one starting up Osmanli in 1897, had, 3 years earlier, successfully won the support of influential religious scholars and Islamic judges while agitating in Istanbul. This was a process that happened parallel to the CUP's efforts to infiltrate the Sublime Porte bureaucracy leading up to the 1896 coup. So we have mentioned these so-called religious scholars and Islamic judges quite a lot in passing, but we need to get a bit more specific in our understanding of this group if we are going to fully grasp why secularized Young Turks like Ishak Shakuti would begin to use the language of religious struggle in their public proclamations. So, this group of religious scholars and Islamic judges are generally referred to as the ulama, which is an Arabic word that literally means those who have knowledge. The ulama had long been and still are a very important force within the politics, culture, and religion of the Islamic world. The roots of the ulama really go all the way back to the earliest days of Islam, when the religion made its rapid advance across Afro-Eurasia by way of the Islamic conquests, which spread Islam all the way from Spain to India to Uzbekistan. And as Islam transformed from being a small esoteric faith limited to the Arabian Peninsula to being one of the most widely practiced religions in the entire world, there quickly became a need for specialists who could interpret the text of the Quran and the other religious teachings of Muhammad. So, a new class of scholars gradually emerged to fill this role, and they would come to be referred to as the ulama. Over the 1,000-year period we are talking about, the ulama did a lot of different things and included a lot of different types of people. And as a massive institution full of brainy scholars who thought really hard about stuff, of course there was always tons of division, really intense arguments, and countless factional disputes within the ulama itself. They were definitely not some monolithic force. But as a general rule, the ulama would do the following things for the Islamic community. First, they would lead prayers and services and offer religious guidance for the community on how to lead a pious life in line with God's will. Then, the ulama would also run schools and were very important in providing education for young people. This not only included religious education, but also math, science, history, philosophy, and logic as well. And then politically speaking, potentially the most important function of the ulama was in their role as Islamic judges, upholding and interpreting Sharia law, and as political advisors for the Islamic caliph and his ministers. This political role of the ulama is ultimately what we are most interested in here. And to fully grasp this political role of the ulama within an Islamic state, we need to first better understand Islamic law, because Islamic law is incredibly easy to misunderstand. So, first things first, when people say Islamic law or Sharia, this does not mean like the Ten Commandments of Moses or anything like that. Islamic law is an extremely complex body of legal codes, civil procedures, and judicial precedents that honestly kind of resembles constitutional law in the United States. At least in the way it functions, because much in the same way that judges in the U.S. are given the task of interpreting the extent to which things adhere to the Constitution, Islamic law operates in kind of the same way, except just replace the secular Constitution with the Holy Quran and the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. In Islamic law, there are two primary foundations that inform court decisions and legal opinions within Islamic states, like the great caliphates of the Islamic Golden Age and like the Ottoman Empire. These two foundations are, first, the Word of God in the Quran, coupled with the teachings and actions of the Prophet Muhammad. These two bodies of texts make up what is traditionally called Sharia. Then second, we have the rational interpretations of the Sharia made by informed scholars and judges, the ulama. This act of interpretation by the ulama is called ijtihad. And the productive tension between the sacred text of the Sharia and the interpretation of these texts through ijtihad is very, very important. To take the first of these, within Islam, the Quran is understood to be the literal word of God, translated through Muhammad, the messenger of God. So, within Islamic law, the text of the Quran takes precedence over all else, and is the foundation upon which everything else sits. But it should be noted that the Quran actually includes a ton of legal opinions, and because the Quran is understood as the word of God, these doctrines are typically followed very strictly. But if an answer cannot be found in the Quran, judges would look toward the words and actions of the Prophet Muhammad made during his lifetime. The words and actions of Muhammad are generally called the Sunnah or the Hadith. The Sunnah of the Prophet is a really, really huge deal. And Sunnah is where you get the title Sunni Muslims, because the Sunnis were historically understood as the group following the traditions of Muhammad, the followers of the Sunnah. So, after the death of Muhammad, Islam would spread at an incredibly rapid pace. And essentially, the rulers who succeeded Muhammad as leaders of the Islamic community, known as caliphs, would take Muhammad's model of religious, military, and political expansion and really run with it. And within just 100 years after the Prophet's death, the Islamic caliphs would conquer a territory stretching all the way from Morocco, Spain, and Portugal in the west over to the Indian subcontinent in what is today Pakistan in the east. So yes, before you ask, the early Islamic caliphates were in fact one of the largest empires in all of human history, up there with the Mongols, the Qing, the Spanish, and the British, at its height ruling close to 10% of the world's territory and nearly 30% of the world's population. So in terms of just sheer size, the Islamic caliphates kind of dwarf things like the Roman Empire at its greatest extent. These rapid-fire conquests in the century directly following Muhammad's death transformed Islam from being an obscure monotheistic religion of the Arabian Peninsula to being one of the most important religious, cultural, political, and social movements in all of history. And the conquered territory of the early caliphates still roughly corresponds to the Islamic world to this day. And following these conquests, a period of great scientific and cultural development arose. And this period, from around the 8th century to the 13th century, is often called the Islamic Golden Age. And during the Islamic Golden Age, the caliphs went from being expansionist military leaders to being emperors having to administer a gigantic geographic space. So the caliphs quickly developed the need for a more streamlined form of governance and a rational code of laws. This need would be filled by the ulama. In their effort to formalize Sharia law and make it applicable to a multi-continent empire, the ulama undertook a very ambitious project to collect as many sunnah, or traditions, of the Prophet Muhammad as they possibly could. And the ulama scholars basically began tracking down everyone who had any sort of connection with the Prophet during his lifetime. The greatest of these projects was taken on by a scholar named al-Bukhari, who would travel all across the Abbasid Caliphate to gather the teachings of the Prophet from people who had older family members who had known Muhammad and had passed on his teachings through the generations. In this project, al-Bukhari collected literally hundreds of thousands of sayings and actions of Muhammad, known as hadith. Then he whittled this giant collection down to just over 7,000 hadith, which he saw as the most authentic representations of the Prophet. This work would become the text representing the sunnah of the Prophet, and it would be consulted by countless ulama jurists for centuries. So, the foundation of Islamic law is the Quran, which is a fairly small book, but which contains a lot of legal opinions, coupled with the Sunnah of the Prophet, which is a gigantic collection of reported teachings, prophecies, and actions made by the Prophet Muhammad while he was still alive. These two bodies of work form the bedrock of Islamic law and are called Sharia. However, if an Islamic judge is unable to find an answer to a legal question in the Quran or in the Sunnah of the Prophet, they would turn to the second major area of Islamic law, rational decision-making and deductive reasoning. And this is where Islamic law is easy to misunderstand, because during the Islamic Golden Age, answers to legal questions were not found in the Quran or in the Sunnah of the Prophet all the time. So for hundreds of years, there was a thriving community of Islamic judges, the ulama, who debated legal theory and used their own mental capacities, known in Islamic law as ijtihad, to come to legal decisions. Ijtihad gave the ulama the ability to reinterpret Sharia law in such a way as to make it more applicable to their specific needs within their specific time period. Meaning that ijtihad historically allowed Islamic law to adapt and respond to new challenges that would inherently come up as the times changed. So, underneath the umbrella of Sharia is this secondary area of ijtihad, the use of mental reasoning and rationality to decide court cases and to offer legal opinions when there are no answers to be found in Sharia. So, when the Islamic Golden Age came to an end after the Mongol conquests, Islamic jurists basically began to feel that the scholars of the past had already seen enough cases to cover just about anything that might come up in the future. This moment is often referred to as the closing of the gate of ijtihad, or in other words, the closing of rational debate and empirical reasoning, as more and more ulama began to simply look towards previous decisions made by their predecessors instead of using their own mental faculties to make legal decisions within their own historical context. This process of closing the gate of ijtihad was very much bound up in the institutionalization of the ulama in the formal codification of Islamic law. The process began to happen during the latter half of the Islamic Golden Age, as ulama scholars became tools of the great Islamic empires. Because as the ulama became an institution of the caliphate, instead of a loose-knit network of independent scholars, rational discussion in ijtihad began to decline, and the ulama basically transformed into a conservative institution. Then, after the Mongols conquered Baghdad and toppled the Abbasid Caliphate in 1258, this network of Islamic scholars was permanently disrupted. So the closing of the gate of Ijtihad had already been ongoing, but the Mongol conquest of the Abbasid Caliphate finished the job and really slammed the gate shut. So the golden age of Islam was the height of the ulama as a dynamic force, and during the Mongol period, Islamic jurisprudence stagnated. But then fast forward a few hundred years, and here come the Ottomans, who would kind of pick things back up where the great caliphs of old had left off. Because the Ottomans would conquer a lot of the territory that had previously been ruled by the Islamic caliphates of the Golden Age. And when Sultan Selim the Grim conquered the Mamluks and brought Egypt, Greater Syria, and the Islamic Holy Lands into the Ottoman Empire, he would officially claim the title of Caliph for the Ottoman dynasty. So it was in 1517 when the Ottoman sultans were transformed into caliphs, and the Ottomans would reinvigorate the caliphate and bring the institution back to a level of global importance that it had not enjoyed since before the Mongol conquests. The Ottoman caliphate was the fourth and last great caliphate of the Islamic world. And Suleiman the Magnificent, who had come to power after Selim the Grim, would really embrace his role as caliph as he re-implemented a lot of the practices that had been used by the caliphs during the Islamic Golden Age. This would include a reinvigoration of the ulama and of Islamic jurisprudence. Suleiman the Magnificent, who would become known as the Lawgiver, embarked on an extremely ambitious plan to reinstitutionalize Sharia law and to redeploy the ulama as an arm of imperial rule. Now, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, a big effort was made during the Tanzimat era in the 1800s to reverse this process and to limit the power of the ulama as law became more secularized and more westernized. But one thing we need to understand here is that the secularization of Ottoman law was a process that had been ongoing really ever since the rule of Suleiman the Magnificent, as Suleiman had specifically tried to integrate Sharia law with secular law. So, going all the way back to the reign of Suleiman, the ulama were used to legitimize the sultan, both as a secular ruler and as the caliph, or head of the Islamic world. That is all to say that there had long been this tension between secular law and religious law. Tanzimat reformers simply sought to heighten the importance of secular law, with the biggest difference being that this focus on secular law was now wrapped up in the process of westernization and modernization. And with all of that said, we have finally made it back. Because one of Sultan Abdul Hamid's biggest departures from the Tanzimat style of governing was that he would try to use the ulama once more as a way in which to legitimize his autocratic rule, following the lead of pre-Tanzimat sultans running all the way back to Suleiman the Magnificent. But this was a very delicate process for Abdul Hamid, because the ulama was a powerful institution, and these Islamic scholars all had their own agendas in mind. And a lot of the ulama didn't really care that Abdul Hamid simply wanted them to just publish proclamations supporting his rightful claim to the title of caliph. And in fact, a ton of the ulama scholars had been on the side of the modernizers, like the young Ottomans during the Tanzimat era. So, even though many ulama would offer their support for Sultan Abdul Hamid's autocratic rule and would welcome his elevation of their institution, just as many ulama would begin to criticize Abdul Hamid and would argue that Islam did not need to revert back to a time before the Tanzimat. Instead, these reformers within the ulama would argue that the Islamic world needed to continue to modernize and to be reformed if it was going to keep up with the West. So, during the Hamidian era, Islamic modernism, that great cause of the young Ottomans and of Midhat Pasha, would be taken up most fervently by the reform wing of the ulama. And the secular young Turks would spend a lot of their energy, especially early on, trying to win support of these reform-minded ulama, because they were such an historically powerful force within the Ottoman Empire.
The ulama was an essential piece of the puzzle when it came to building a coalition that would be strong enough to take down Abdul Hamid. So, I want to end today's episode by specifically focusing on the ulama down in Cairo, and to trace the rise of two ulama members in particular, who are often pointed to as the founders of Islamic modernism. For over 1,000 years, the Al-Azhar University in Cairo had been the center of Islamic scholarship and the top school for Islamic jurisprudence in the Sunni Islamic world. And in the late 19th century, a group of scholars would emerge at Al-Azhar University who would represent the leading edge of Islamic modernism. These scholars began to make very convincing arguments that the Islamic world needed to modernize fast if the onslaught of European imperialism was going to be halted. The two founding fathers of this movement are Jamal al-Din al-Afghani and Muhammad Abduh, who would form a very important teacher-student relationship that would define the future direction of Islamic modernism. So, let's start with the teacher. Jamal al-Din al-Afghani grew up as a listless youth from Central Asia, who traveled to British India as a teenager, where he witnessed the aftermath of the Great Indian Rebellion of 1857, which attempted but ultimately failed to drive out the colonial presence of the British East India Company. This time spent in British India following these anti-imperial uprisings would stamp al-Afghani's politics for the rest of his life, as one of his great missions in life would be putting an end to British imperialism within the Islamic world. After he left India, al-Afghani would continue to lead a restless and nomadic life, traveling throughout the Islamic world and gaining prominence as a writer and speaker, always arguing for the need for aggressive modernization, educational reform, and Islamic unity, all in order to combat British imperialism. And al-Afghani would actually end up in Istanbul for a few years, where he was appointed to the Council of Education, and where he would influence young Ottomans like Namik Kemal, who were drawn to al-Afghani's conception of a united and modernized Islamic world. However, it would be in Cairo where al-Afghani would settle for the longest period of time and where he would have the most lasting influence as he cultivated a dedicated following of fellow modernizers who came to share al-Afghani's vision for a reformed and reinvigorated Islam that could withstand the pressures of European imperialism. One of al-Afghani's proteges in Cairo would be the young Muhammad Abduh, who would in time come to eclipse his teacher in importance within the Islamic modernist movement. As a young man, Muhammad Abduh had received a traditional Islamic education in Egypt, and as a devout Muslim, he had spent much of his youth on a quest for spiritual awakening. But as he grew older, Abduh became dissatisfied with the state of Islamic education in Egypt, which he felt had deviated too far from the original teachings of Islam, as it had become infused with mysticism and superstitious folklore. Then, in 1866, when Abduh was 17, he enrolled at the Al-Azhar University in Cairo, where he studied logic and Islamic philosophy, and when he first became a student of al-Afghani. And from this point on, the two modernizers would embark on a very close student-teacher relationship. After studying under al-Afghani for 8 years, Muhammad Abduh would gain a position at the Al-Azhar University in Cairo as a professor of history. But then, in 1879, both al-Afghani and Muhammad Abduh would come to play a role in Urabi's revolt, which we talked about in episode 2.4, The Veiled Protectorate, in which overthrew the reigning Khedive Ismail and replaced him with the new Khedive Tawfiq. And we didn't talk about this, but a big reason why there was initial excitement around placing Tawfiq onto the Egyptian throne was because he was a member of the Freemasons in Egypt. Al-Afghani and Muhammad Abduh were both themselves major figures within the Masonic lodges leading up to Urabi's revolt, and they would use Freemasonry to build solidarity among reform-minded Egyptians with the hope of gaining the strength necessary to oppose European imperialism. So this is kind of similar to how Midhat Pasha and Prince Murad mingled as Freemasons leading up to the 1876 coup. Except in Egypt, Freemasonry would play an even more direct role in Urabi's revolt through Al-Afghani, Muhammad Abdu, and Khedive Taufik, all of whom were Freemasons. But as we did talk about, the unexpected result of Urabi's revolt was that it actually ended up provoking the British to invade and occupy Egypt, allegedly in order to protect British nationals. But let's be real, the invasion was meant to ensure the continued operation of the Suez Canal. The British occupation of Egypt would end up lasting for over 70 years. And for Al-Afghani and Muhammad Abdu, it was just yet more proof that British imperialists were slowly taking over the entire Islamic world. This was the same thing Al-Afghani had seen go down during his travels, because following Urabi's revolt in 1882, the British Empire now controlled Egypt, the Sudan, the entire Indian subcontinent, including modern India and Pakistan, and they had begun to exert a ton of influence in many parts of Al-Afghani's home country in Central Asia, including Afghanistan and southern Persia. And finally, for Al-Afghani and Muhammad Abdu personally, the collapse of Urabi's revolt and the resulting British occupation of Egypt would force both scholars into temporary exile as they left Egypt and made their way to, yep, you guessed it, Paris. While in Paris, Al-Afghani and Muhammad Abdu would start up a newspaper in 1884, and this paper would end up having a major influence on the course of the Islamic reform movement, because it would be in Paris that Al-Afghani and Abdu would really begin to crystallize their vision for Islamic modernism. And their paper would begin to open up a broader conversation amongst Muslim intellectuals as they argued for why modernization needed to happen and how exactly that modernization should be brought about. Critically, one of the primary ideologies of this paper was anti-imperialism, and Al-Afghani and Abdu would take specific aim at the increasing British colonial presence in the Islamic world. Al-Afghani and Abdu recognized that the British Empire was incredibly powerful, and so they argued that the only way that Muslims would be able to stand up to the might of the British Empire would be if they did the following things. Number one, Muslims needed to put aside their sectarian differences and to unite as fellow Muslims in a broad pan-Islamic effort to push the British out of the East. Number two, Muslims needed to return to the original tenets of Islam, as they argued that a big reason why the Muslim world had recently come under the domination of Western powers was because people had strayed too far from the original principles of Islam. For Al-Afghani and Abdu, the best way in which to combat European colonialism was to reinvigorate Islam by getting back to the basics, to return to the direct teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, and to model their societies off of the earliest Muslim communities. They looked at the history of Islam and saw things like the great Islamic conquests and the Islamic Golden Age, and they began to wonder why the Islamic world had strayed so far from this period of greatness. So, from the very beginning, this strand of Islamic modernism, growing out of the ideas of Al-Afghani and Muhammad Abdu, would always have an element of Islamic revivalism. The answer was not to completely change or get rid of Islam, but to bring it back to its previous glory. But Al-Afghani and Abdu were still both reformers, and they felt that it was essential to adapt Islam to modern times. The great scholars of the Islamic Golden Age, to whom many modern scholars still looked for answers, had literally been active during the Middle Ages. So Abdu and Al-Afghani argued for the need to reopen the gate of ijtihad, to reopen rational debate, and to begin to question the traditional applications of Islamic law. So their effort to revive the historic greatness of Islam would come to center around reforming Islamic law, because Al-Afghani and Abdu would argue that a lot of Islamic law was just outdated at this point and was no longer applicable within a modern context. Later in his life, Muhammad Abdu would be allowed to return to Cairo, and he would himself build a very large following of ulama at the Al-Azhar University in the late 1890s and early 1900s. Muhammad Abdu and his circle at Al-Azhar would openly debate the best ways in which to go about modernizing Islam, and the issues brought up by Abdu and his followers are in many ways still the key issues being discussed within the Islamic world up to this very day. Importantly, almost all of these issues centered around the best way in which to respond to European imperialism and the advances of Western society in science, technology, education, and politics. So, first and foremost was the debate over whether or not to reopen the gate of ijtihad at all. Modernists surrounding Abdu argued that rational debate needed to be rekindled if the Islamic world was going to be able to keep up with the West. Then, when it came to Islamic law specifically, the question was essentially, did Sharia law need to be updated through ijtihad in order to adapt it to an ever-changing modern world? The most pressing issues again would surround Westernization. Islamic modernists would argue that the spirit of Islam was egalitarian and open to new ideas, not autocratic and irrationally traditional. So, Muhammad Abdu and his followers would argue that Sharia law needed to be updated, specifically concerning such issues as the role of women in society, the treatment of religious minorities, and the role of democratic governance. Muhammad Abdu argued that it was essential for Islamic women to be given the opportunity to engage in the public sphere. He also argued that religious minorities should enjoy legal equality in Muslim-majority countries, and he would argue for the need to democratize Islamic governance. Now, what is important to note here is that Muhammad Abdu presented all of these arguments through the lens of Islam, not secularization. Muhammad Abdu argued that the early Islamic societies during the life of Muhammad and directly following his death were rooted in these very principles. Muhammad Abdu argued that the prevention of women from entering the public sphere, the maltreatment of Christians and Jews, and the autocratic rule of despotic caliphs like Abdul Hamid had a lot more to do with cultural precedent and just conservative tradition than it did with the actual primary texts of Islam. Abdu would specifically point to passages from the Quran and to the Sunnah of the Prophet and argue that the Prophet Muhammad in fact supported the rights of women, pushed for religious tolerance, and favored a consultative approach to governance. And you should all be thinking now, hey, aren't these like the exact same arguments that secular young Turks like Ahmed Reza were making at this same time? And yes, you are exactly right, and this is in fact the point. The arguments for reforming and modernizing the Islamic world were coming from many different angles. This included secular young Turks, as well as pious reformers amongst the Islamic modernists. And many of the ulama in Cairo would actually join the CUP in the late 1890s. And these reform-minded ulama at Al-Azhar University would come to heavily influence the ideology of young Turks through this Cairo branch of the CUP. And this would represent yet another critical alliance forged in opposition to Abdul Hamid. The alliance between secular young Turks and Islamic modernists amongst the ulama in Cairo. And even though Ahmed Reza and other young Turks were very critical of traditional religious institutions, and even though many of these ulama often derided the young Turks as atheists, these two groups would still have in common a shared opposition to the autocratic policies of Abdul Hamid, and possibly even more importantly, they would generally agree on the key issue of how to respond to Western imperialism. Ahmed Reza, Abdullah Chevdet, Ali Ilghanem all pretty much agreed with Al-Afghani and Muhammad Abdu on the idea that the Islamic world needed to take the most beneficial ideas, technologies, and political modes of governing coming out of the West without becoming subservient to the West. Islamic society should be modernized while still maintaining its unique Islamic character. On this central point, secular Young Turks and reform-minded ulama were in general agreement. And as we will see next week, this question of how to deal with Western Europe will create the great rift in the opposition movement going into the 20th century. Because in 1899, the Sultan's own brother-in-law will defect and join the opposition, and he will bring a whole bunch of high-ranking administrators along with him. And as the Young Turk movement becomes filled once more with such high-ranking officials, these officials will begin to push hard for a foreign intervention into Ottoman internal affairs, with the goal of using a great power to depose Abdul Hamid on behalf of the opposition. And critically, the top choice for this foreign intervention will be the British. And seeing as we have just spent the entire second half of this episode talking about all the different anti-imperialist efforts to kick the British out of the Islamic world, you could probably understand why this involvement of the British to overthrow Abdul Hamid would be a wee bit controversial. So, next week we will follow the Young Turks back over to Paris, as the Sultan's brother-in-law seeks to unite the many different factions of the opposition by putting together the movement's very first Congress. But instead of uniting the opposition, the Young Turks will split in two over this issue of foreign intervention. So, join me next week as we finally get to the actual real-life 20th century, and as the Young Turks reach a pivotal moment in their history, and try and come together at the First Congress of the Ottoman Opposition.